Coming to you direct from the nerve center of the galaxy's greatest comic. This is the 2000 AD Thrillcast.
Borag Thung, Earthlitz, and welcome to the latest episode of the 2000 AD Thrillcast Lockdown Tapes. I am your host, as always, Molchar. And on this episode, we've got a couple of creators who've popped up a couple of times on the podcast this year, Rob Williams and Chris Weston, who are here to talk about their collection, Judge Dredd Control, which is out at the beginning of December. Now, this is the collection of the Judge Pin stories, one of the great new villains for Judge Dredd that have come up over the last few years. Great to see something different being done with the Special Judicial Squad, and of course, Chris's amazing artwork. So definitely not one to be missed. Like I said, it's out in time for Christmas, so make sure you get that on your list for Santa Claus. So we talk about some of the themes behind the collection, the humour stories that are in there as well. Fans of Sensitive Clegg will definitely want to pick up this collection. It was wonderful to be able to natter away. In the meantime, I hope you've all ordered your Christmas bumper issue of 2000 AD if you're not already subscribers. It's available to pre-order from 2000 AD. 100 pages of absolutely tip-top thrill power, which you cannot afford to miss. So head along to shop.2000ad.com. We've also just launched Christmas gift vouchers, so if you want to buy some thrill power for your loved ones, then you can get various different subscription options, and they get free gifts as well, not just 50% off vouchers, but also badges, which very exciting stuff. Wear your thrill power with pride, Earthlitz. So yeah, head along to the shop and check all of those out. And pretty soon we're going to be announcing our schedules for 2021. Very exciting time. Hopefully things getting back onto a bit of an even keel after the disruption of this year. So without much further ado, let's crack on and have a chat with Rob Williams and Chris Weston about Judge Dredd Control. So, I've had you both on the podcast since the beginning of first lockdown to talk all things Dredd. But because the Control collection is coming up quite rapidly at the beginning of December, I wanted to just kind of dive into it in a little bit more depth, because I think it's really interesting from both a writing and artistic point of view, what you guys do with this in the figure of Judge Pin, because the SJS has always been there in, it's always been like background stuff, you know, in Dredd's universe. You had the Day the Lord Died, where they were introduced. There's been various times where they've cropped up. But with Judge Pin, it feels like you're doing something a little bit different. Do you want to tell me about how that character came to be? Was it a character that you came up with and then created the sort of thread for, or was it actually, we want to do this kind of story and this is the character that appears?
Yeah, I'll let Rob go first.
But my memory's just awful. I was thinking about this before doing this and I thought, oh my God, I've forgotten most of it. So I can't remember. I mean, I think it was a case of, I think Chris and I, we would talk on the phone a lot. And we would talk about, you know, one of the things Dredd does in its history is create these amazing villains and then kill them almost immediately. And Dredd, we kind of went, well, so a lot of the classic Dredd villains are kind of are gone. They're, you know, they're not around for you to play with. And I think the conversation, Chris, you can correct me if I'm wrong, was like, we need to give Dredd a really good villain again, basically. And then it was the case of how we go about doing that. But it was, I think, like most of the things in the Control collection, but Chris and I, most of the stories that are in there and the ideas that are in there are usually born out of Chris and I on the phone, just knocking stuff back and forth, really. And more, one of the nice things about it is it's more like general chats than it is about, right, let's build a story, you know? I think just about everything in there, for the ones we've done together, are very organic sort of constructions of just Chris and I nattering rather than sort of I'll write the script, you draw it, you know. So there's a lot of there's an awful lot of, I'm down as the writer, but there's an awful lot of the ideas in there, you know, might as may well be from me or from Chris. It's just kind of, it's tough to see the join, which is like kind of one of the fun things about it, really.
We generate way more ideas than we actually use, don't we? We could probably write about 100 times the amount of dread stories we do if I could only draw quicker.
It's also, I remember things like with the last pin episode where I was stuck on one thing and I was, then I rang Chris up and I think Chris said about, I might be misremembering this, about four words and I went, that's it, I've got it. And it's just like, sometimes you just, I think, well, without giving it away, if people are going to read it, but it was just, it was effectively, you know, how we put Dredd in this position where he's,
we couldn't get him out of it.
The ground, and we were going, how the hell do we get him out of it? And then it was a kind of odd, it'll come, you know, and then it does. And then sometimes you just, this happens with writing. Sometimes it's a very solitary thing. And sometimes you just need to speak to another person and within about 2 seconds of speaking to another person, you go, oh, and you've got it, you know? So it's kind of really healthy, you know, to sort of be able to talk it through in that regard.
He had to get out of it by himself, you know, so we didn't want him to be rescued, did we? So we really had to bang our heads against that one.
Rob mentioned something there, which is has often been raised regarding Dredd's character, nemesis, the villains of the piece, is that Dredd has a tendency to shoot them. And the number of recurring characters that have escaped this fate, I mean, you could count them on the fingers of one hand, practically. With someone like Pin, was she always going to have a finite life?
No, I mean, I think we could have carried on writing her for years, but the trouble with me is I have quite an erratic schedule, so, you know, we're in danger of starting something that never got finished, so we just reached a decision, you know, more for the readers, you know, there's, you know, than for us, that, you know, maybe we ought to actually give this story a proper ending.
One thing we liked about it was the pacing of it was like, we do one story and effectively you tease the first act and then go away and there's a ton of other Dredd stories. You know, she's still there. She's still operating and killing behind the scenes, because she's, I mean, we should say she's an SJS judge, but she is also a serial killer. And because, as you find out as the story goes on, she believes that the sort of the purity of the judge's uniform and the badge, if you don't live up to that, if you let the standards drop, and you shouldn't be on the streets, and so she'll take care of you. You know, she's got a very twisted, extreme view of the SJS's overall sort of raison d'etre. So, but it's and then we sort of we told one pin story and went away, and then we came back and we told another pin story, and we sort of we were dropping her in and dropping her out, which was kind of nice. We could have kept going with it.
I kind of wanted there's a whole section we never really got round to it, where I kind of wanted Dredd works out that this person killing judges has inside information, so he's obviously a judge. So he would then go to the SJS to try and find out who this crooked judge is. So basically, I wanted Dredd to give Judge Pin the job of finding herself, which is a whole section we never really got the chance to do, which is a shame. I'd like to have done that.
But it's kind of, in terms of a genesis as well, I mean, the name was like deliberately, I think I'd been reading Roald Dahl with my daughter, and this sort of like she's almost, there's partly sort of a bit of Roald Dahl in her. The name is sort of very sort of, all Roald Dahl's villains are sort of things like Pin felt like a very on the nose villainy name, which is the type of thing Roald Dahl does, you know, pins people in. And then I think the other thing was there was a Theresa May was going through a lot in the time, and there's a degree of Theresa May in there as well.
I mean, at that point, we thought things couldn't get any worse, didn't we?
Yeah, I know, exactly. But I mean, I kind of like the androgynous sort of visual aspect of Pin as well.
That's only because I'm rubbish at drawing women.
Well, a lot of people when they were said it's a she, quite a few people was, I thought Pin was a man, you know, which is like...
Yeah, every time I heard that, I died a little bit more inside.
There's a certain feeling that she could be, she isn't, and never will be, but she could easily, in another story, be a dark judge, turn into that, you know, from beyond the grave.
That was discussed, wasn't it? Yeah.
That was discussed, yeah. So there's all these things kind of like, you know, sort of filtered into her.
With Pin and her attitude towards authority and her power, did you feel that you were making a further comment beyond what Robbie you've done in things like The Small House about the nature of the judges and their tendency for lack of oversight, if it were? If the person in charge of oversight of the judges themselves a serial killer, then you're kind of screwed, really, aren't you?
I don't think Pin's got... I mean, there's a reason it's called Control. And it's, as you see in her origin, it's not really anything to do with the judges, to be honest with you. I mean, I guess it goes through to a broader point, which is a theme that's in my Dread World work anyway, probably, is about, I think, people use their jobs and their badges as almost like excuses to sort of give them what they need from a life, basically. And I think she, as you see in her origin, she goes insane, and that is the very definition of being out of control, a mind out of control. So the rules she sets down, however warped to us, allow her to keep control, because otherwise she will just lose it. And and there's a reason why in the origin tale it's all black and white. When you see her origin tale, and then when she first kills her first judge, the color comes in, and it's all about sort of the parameters, you know, keeping things within controllable parameters for her, basically, you know, and definitions and things she can handle. So in that sense, I don't really think, you know, even though she's SJS and she's a judge, I don't think it's got much to do with the law. It's got anything to do with the law, really. It's a very personal, I will use this power in order to, you know, give me what I need.
Chris, in terms of your take on the physicality of the character, I mean, you've already mentioned your difficulty drawing women, but there's something about the way that you portray Pin. Number one, I'd love the kind of physicality of her name, the idea of just this straight down creature with this horrible head on top. Take us through your process of creating the look of Pin.
I don't think it just required, I think, much thought, really. She just sprung fully formed to mind, really. Again, you know, when you start with the name Pin, it obviously lends itself to a sort of angular figure, sort of with the sharp corners. Just instantly, you know, assumed she was quite thin, you know, thin figured. And also, I wanted to avoid that cliche of whenever a comic strip artist draws a female character, instantly gives them massive boobs. So I wanted to make her quite flat-chested. I think you probably noticed towards the end of the series, when after I got so fed up with everyone telling me they thought she was a man, I did slightly increase her bust size. So I leaned into the cliche a bit towards the end. But from the beginning, I wanted her to be quite flat-chested.
No, is it not difficult to draw that huge SJS badge on her chest as well? Which is, I mean, people talk about Dredd's eagle, shoulder eagle being the most impractical thing, but the SJS badge is...
So impractical.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the things I was going to ask about was where you took inspiration from in terms of the uniform of the SJS, because it has had numerous variations.
It has,
Over the years. Were you tempted to drop the massive... chest eagle?
Oh no, I like the massive chest eagle. Yeah, no, I like that ridiculousness. I mean, that was Bolland, wasn't it? Wasn't Bolland who drew that? So any opportunity to, you know, wear Bolland's shoes around the house, I'll happily take.
He's very much a massive chest eagle type of man. But also, you drew the SJS hall, didn't you? Which was like, was that the first time seen the interiors of it? I've forgotten.
But, and I wisely gave it a vaulted ceiling, didn't I?
Yeah.
That's talk about making life difficult for myself. But I wanted it to be like a monastery or something, because this is like they're the hardcore judges, so they would have the purest version of justice. So I wanted to make sort of connections with a religious connection. So I thought, well, it's got to look like a cathedral, so like a medieval cathedral. So I gave it a vaulted ceiling, little thinking.
And isn't the pickled guy from Cattle? Is it?
Yeah, Slocum? I mean, I love doing that. Yeah,
you put him in the hall. So if you go in, you've got to walk past a pickled judge to go in and out of the SJS hall, which is.
It's like the ultimate deterrent of, you know, when a judge goes bad, isn't it? He's put on display. He's like a head on a pike.
Well, there is that wonderful phase during the Day the Lord Died where you've got McMahon and Bolland alternating.
Yeah.
And the SJS costumes alternate back and forth because nobody had told them to draw it differently.
Yeah. There were two different... SJS uniforms at that point, weren't they? And then you get like a Brett Ewins issue where he's swiping everyone and he's got both versions of the costume in there.
I always find the SJS stuff interesting because so many of the stories over the years have naturally rested on questions of corruption and the whole, you know, who watches the watchman of the watchman, etc., etc. Whereas with Pin, the corruption is in her. You know, it's not a moral corruption. It's psychological corruption, much more. And it's interesting to see a judge suffering from the one thing we're told that the vast majority of citizens of Mega City 1 suffer from, which is future shock.
Mm.
You know, when things get so completely overwhelming. It's an interesting and different reaction to, say, for example, what Gordon Rennie and Emma Beebe were doing in the immediate aftermath of the Day of Chaos, where, you know, it was just, there was a palpable sense of despair at the sheer death toll. But with Pin, it's much more of that kind of classic goes mad, loses the thread of themselves.
But then she grabs a tether, and it was like, it's not dissimilar to sort of, I guess, what I would have written in the past with Dirty Frank. And Dirty Frank, his tether that stops him flailing off into the abyss is justice. And so for Pin, it just happens to be sort of the opposite, and sort of murder. Is you know what I mean? That's how the universe makes sense for her. But it's like, I mean, how would you not, right? In the post chaos day when she's seeing all these enormous trucks putting thousands of bodies into pits right in front of her, it's just like something snaps. So on that happy note,
Well, it's something that I think it was Kenneth Nyland said about. You know, did the citizens forget Cal, and do they forget Necropolis and the Apocalypse War and all that? You know, it's particularly when it comes to the democracy referendum. Do they forget when the judges went mad a few years ago and sentenced the entire city to death?
But I think, what we've just been going through this year is kind of interesting in that regard, I think, because I what amazed me with COVID, and like even when we had at its worst, and it was 1,000 people dying a day, right? So in any other context, if you told us that's coming round the corner, we'd all be like, whoa! And how quickly everyone just got on, this is life as normal now. And I think that kind of like what human beings probably do, you know, it's just like, this is what it is. So we carry on, you know, because you can't, I don't think unless it's happening to you, we're all very subjective. Unless anything's actually happening to you, I don't think you can grasp that it's even out there, even if it's, you're told that it's two streets down. Do you know what I mean? So I suspect they're like, yeah, okay. What else can they do? They can't, you know, it's that all hell trekking across the cursed earth. I don't think they fancy that very much.
No. And the apocalypse, stuff like the apocalypse war is so long ago now. It's only really old people like us that remember it.
Oh, yeah. They age in real time.
It's the boiling frog metaphor, isn't it? You know, you don't notice the steady buildup of heat over time. One person we haven't talked about is Dredd. In this collection, which is Judge Dredd Control. To a certain extent, do you feel he takes a bit of a backseat in this? Or is it like many of the enemies that he's faces, that he has faced over the years, is it a case of they don't make sense unless he does, and he doesn't make sense unless they do?
There are, considering we're making it a psychological, you know, the pin story is the forward story, but there are other stories in Control, and a lot of them are quite funny and, you know, very silly and have talking monkeys and things like that, which in which case Dredd is far more your traditional Dredd stories. But it's, I don't know, how does he feel about it? I don't know if he... I think, you know, obviously with what something that happens towards the end of a pin story, it's kind of personal for him, but for the most part, it's more just a creeping inclination growing that there's something's not quite right, but he follows and sort of that takes him down this road. Pin focuses on him far more than he focuses on her until he's up to his neck in the ground and being tortured. So it's not really, I don't think he gives until right at the end, I don't think he gives Pin much more thought than she's another creep and needs taking down, really.
I mean, you make a good point there about the humanist collection, because of course it's not just the Judge Pin stories that are in this one. We've also got the Sensitive Clegg who pops up. So you've got really grim and really slapstick funny. For those who haven't encountered Sensitive Clegg before, please explain.
Well, he's Rob's creation. I'll let Rob take this one.
Me and Disraeli, actually, I think in Trifecta, and it was just a very throwaway thing with a Clegg. I just thought it was funny that Cleggs are so sort of carnivorous and giant alien crocodiles, and they eat everything, and they're all sort of, just eat human flesh. But if you met one who was completely the opposite and was just like born in the wrong body and just is a sensitive, poetic soul. And immediately it's just like a really simple idea that just clicked. And then, so we brought him to Mega City One, and of course he's the ultimate sort of, fish out of water, and just like he's a deeply in the most brutal sort of city in the world in terms of where people are just horrible everywhere, and he's just a really beautiful soul. I mean, so the Hunters Club then come after him. I think that was your idea, Chris, wasn't it? The Hunters Club come after him. I reread that little, was it 2-3 part of you, a couple of weeks back, and it's very silly, but I think it's really good, actually. I think it's just like it's line after line, which is But it works because he's really sympathetic. You do really feel sorry for him, I think. You know what I mean?
But, I think there's always room for Dredd to have a sidekick occasionally. I mean, some of the best Dredd stories, you know, I can think of, he's got some version of a sidekick, whether it's Walter or Spikes Harvey Rotten or Tweak. And I just wanted to throw back to that sort of thing.
But it's kind of Walter-y, isn't it? In as much that Sensitive Claire absolutely loves Judge Dredd, and Judge Dredd cannot be in the same room as him. It just really makes him.
He's Walter cubed, isn't he?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I think at one point he's sort of in that story, Dredd says something like, for the first time in a very long career, he wonders if it's wrong to side with the perp who is trying to shoot Sensitive Clegg. But there's that one. There's the space elevator story as well, which again has got some really funny stuff in it, which is very short and sharp. But that's some beautiful art as well. I mean, just absolutely extraordinary art. But yeah, I mean, we crammed a lot into that space elevator story, didn't we?
Oh my gosh, yeah.
But you know, with Chris, because at one point there's like this incredible opening vista shot of like the space elevator above Mega City 1 that makes your eyes bleed to even look at it. And then you notice, if you scroll in through the portholes, he's even drawn the actual carpet inside the space elevator. It's very detailed, and you're there going, Chris, what are you doing, man? You're going to kill yourself.
It's going to have a nice carpet, isn't it, in there?
It's lovely. Did you get that texture? I asked you about that. I emailed you at the time, and you went, oh, I got the texture from that from somewhere. I mean, it's just...
I can't remember where I got that from now. Probably photographed it somewhere on my travels.
Well, I was going to ask about this, because you do have quite an intense style, Chris.
Yeah.
And you've commented before how, not just in this episode, but previously, how sometimes you feel that perhaps it gets in the way of volume of output.
Yes, yeah. I mean, well luckily, this is why I balance my comic book work with the film work, because the film work pays far greater. So that allows me to go back to my first love, comics, and take my time over it, really, and do things the way I want to do it rather than the way someone's telling me to do it. So I don't think I could do it without having this more profitable sideline, really. It's just a question of balancing it out and hoping I get an occasional film job to pay for it, really.
You must have looked at a page and thought, I could probably cut out a few stages of this.
Only once I've drawn it, by then it's too late. I mean, if I could see it in my head beforehand and go, oh yeah, no, I don't need to draw every city block in this. It never crosses my mind beforehand. It's only afterwards going, I don't really need to do all that. I think I finally worked it out why I do it as well. I think I finally psychoanalyzed myself enough and come up with the reason for it. And I think it's because I had so much good luck at the beginning of my career, meeting Don Lawrence and Don Lawrence helping me, and then getting on to 2080, like while I was still, how old was I, 19, still just sort of in my teens. I just think, God, you know, I'm here because of luck. Now I need to start earning it, really. I think I work really, really hard, put the hours in now to compensate for all the good luck that I had at the beginning of my career. I think that's the deep psychological reason, because I really was a lucky bastard the way I got in. And I wasn't ready for it either. I really should have had a few more years outside of the industry learning how to draw before I got a job, but I was really lucky and I got in and did all my improving and learning on the job. But it must be quite annoying for other artists to, at the time, who were thinking, oh my God, I've been to university, I know how to draw this. Why is he on the comic?
I think you're always going to get people doing that. That you know, they look at stuff probably think, well, I could probably do better than that. But at the end of the day, it's you were there, you were doing it. You know, it's I don't think it's luck. Otherwise, you wouldn't have stuck around. That sounds wrong. You wouldn't have been around for as long as you have. Certainly not to be in the position where you are.
No,
I guess.
But I feel like I paid my dues later. I got the job, mucked about with it for a few years, and now as it's going on, now I think I paid my dues later on, really. I put the work in later on, really. That's the way I see it.
I guess also, if you're in the kind of position where, you know, you two clearly work well together, and you're able to put ideas back and forth, and, you know, then go to Matt Smith and say, we've got a story, we want to do it, and, you know, touch wood, fingers crossed, Matt says, yeah, I like the sound of that. I mean, that's quite a place to be in comics full stop, I guess.
Yeah. Again, I feel really lucky, you know.
I think it's kind of, you know, our running joke is we're like Werner Herzog and Klaus Kinski, right? So it kind of works until we kill each other at some point, which you know, is it's more likely Chris will kill me than the other way around. I mean, Chris has, you know, better ideas some very often than me. You know, it's like he's and he's written a couple of ones in this himself as well, of course. You know, so. It's kind of nice, you know. It always has been really nice. We just, like you say, we're going full circle. We just speak on the phone and we knock ideas back and forth. So at its best, it doesn't particularly feel like work, and it's never felt forced. I guess because you're doing movie work and I'm doing other stuff, it's not like we're kind of like we have to do this. It's just kind of like, oh, that'd be fun, which sort of So thus far, it's worked really well.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're not Pat and John sat in a shed down the bottom of the garden trying not to be poisoned by the heater and getting on each other's wicks.
We have quite quickly to do this again. We haven't done one for a while, man, because you've been off in movie land, and now you're we've talked about another sensitive Clegg, and
yeah, that will happen eventually.
Yeah, we might do it. We'll see.
Yeah. Well, you've got a good idea for one.
In terms of structure with something like this, we've already talked about you bringing Pin's story to a close, and, you know, conveniently it's enough to fit in a trade with you know, a few other stories. And I'm always interested in this question. How much of this is intuition? How much of it is planning? You know, do you just kind of... making it up as you go along it sounds quite dismissive, but just kind of you're feeling your way, you know, what feels good, what feels right, you do, and if there's a circumstance where you can work together, you can. So it only really feels kind of planned in hindsight, if you see what I mean. Do you have a sense of that?
I think we're just winging it, aren't we?
Yeah. I don't think there's ever been, you know, at other times you sort of have certain things. Yeah, you know, with the Pin thing, I think we knew a rough idea of where it was going in the end, but certain details still needed to be ironed out. But no,
part... Head of dread, because there's other writers doing their own thing with it as well, so we can't suddenly make these massive, world-changing decisions without... you know, involving other writers, really.
Yeah. There's not, you're not in control of Dredd's universe. So, I guess you can't. And there's always the thing that, like, John might decide to do a story or something, you know what I mean? Which could sort of circumnavigate whatever you've got in mind. It's pretty much entirely winging it. Funnily enough, I was just looking at the America Lost and Found book the other day, and I thought one thing I loved in that was the fact John saying, American comics, they tend to like you to give them the entire story all planned out, because but I don't really do that, I just make it up as I go along. So that's kind of like inherent in Dredd's DNA anyway, I think, possibly.
It's the kind of churn of not churn the turnover of supporting characters recently has kind of picked up, and a lot of them have met their demise at your hands, Rob.
Oh yeah, sorry. There is one that gets it in control, which I was very sad to do, but I thought the way we did it was I really liked, and I thought that was the right way for that particular person. I thought that was a particularly cruel way to do it as well. It was a really horrible way to do it. But yeah, that was part of the appeal, really. It was entirely, without saying it was spoiling it, but it was entirely inspired by, I was thinking of The Shining. And what was the name of the guy? Is it Scatman Crothers? Who all the way through The Shining film is coming to the rescue. And just when he does, do you know what I mean?
I was thinking of the sheriff in Misery, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's Stephen King, right? It's a very, that's a Stephen King beat. Oh, here comes the cavalry. But no.
Yeah.
That is inherent in sort of part of Dredd's world, but it is.
How did it again with Maitland? It was like, no one would expect us to do it twice, you know? Gerhardt's dead, but Maitland will save him, you know. No.
Spoilers.
I like the way, all the way through that, Rob was being very careful not to say that.
Yeah. But since we've done, just the fact that Dredd is buried up to his neck and can't move, so he can't see that his friend, in Dredd's loose terms, is dead right behind the back of his head, and he just couldn't turn his neck to see that.
I wonder if anyone wrote in and said they spotted the boot in the background.
We talked about it. We said, like, that was really one thing for Chris was, like, you know, you can draw Dredd's head, but you can't make, we knew that Gerhardt was there, but we just couldn't actually show it. So it was like, you can't show a wide shot without, you know. So, yeah, it was, that was a particularly, but I really like Gerhardt, sort of built him up for years as well. So that was like, it is one of these things where you do kind of go, oh, that was a good, you are cutting off your, nose to spite your face a little bit sometimes.
He very much felt like your Judge Logan, you know, because Wagner has tortured Logan before finally making him chief judge, and you pretty much blew up every single part of Gerhardt from nose to forehead, really.
He initially got blown up, and then he got sort of stabbed and ripped apart by Amy Nixon as an ice creature. And then finally he got, he did kill Smiley, I guess. He had his moment in the sun there. And then he had his throat slit by the pin. So there you go. So poor Gerhardt. Who will give him a statue?
I mean, that kind of brings me on to talking about supporting characters a bit more, because it's something that most writers over the last 20 years have sort of dabbled in, as it feels like Wagner has done so. You know, introducing more and more supporting characters, and they come and go. What's aside from the obvious kind of, well, it's nice to have characters to do things. What's the advantage of introducing long-running supporting actors in an ongoing serial like Judge Dredd? Can it be sometimes a bit of a hindrance that these are stories that, you know, you feel have to play out?
No, I mean, it's good. I think, go on, you go.
I just wanted to put in, I think some of my favourite Judge Dredd stories haven't been about Judge Dredd. I mean, I think Chopper, Song of the Surfer is amazing. It's not about Dredd. Mandroid isn't about Dredd. America isn't about Dredd. I kind of see Dredd as kind of like the crypt keeper in a Tales from the Crypt story. He's just the device that's used to tell other, you know, short stories set in Mega City 1, really. Obviously, you've got to come back to him every now and then. But that's, I think that's the great thing about Judge Dredd stories, is you can go off on little diversions for a while and then and then come back. Usually comes in at the end and kills whoever this story has been about.
There's a great scene in one of the stories in Control with the Dread family Christmas dinner where it's kind of...
I wanted to talk about that.
Yeah, it's Dolman, who is a Dread clone, right? And there's his niece and... I'm blanking. Have you ever cloned a Dread?
Rico,
thank you, sorry. And just this thing with like the most awkward Christmas dinner in the world where they all sit down and when they all just greet each other and it's Dread, Dolman, Dread.
I think Rico, Dread, Rico. In retrospect, I think we made the mistake of having that other storyline. The whole story should have just been that dinner. If you could do it again, I would say, let's just forget everything. Let's just make the story about the dinner. It would have been great.
And I just loved the fact that sort of his niece had brought her boyfriend along and the poor guy is sat in sort of the Dread Christmas dinner. It was just the worst Christmas, which is like just an exaggeration of a lot of awkward family Christmas dinners, isn't it, really? But just amped up to a million degrees, really. But the supporting characters, you can just drop them in and take, you know, use them as and when. And I think we've all got the regular Dread writers, we've all got our own little supporting cast, you know. And you kind of go, they're yours because there can be stakes with them. They can die or not die. But you know, you don't... And then, you know, I'm sure Kenneth Nyman's got his and Mike Carroll's got his. And, you know, it's just... I mean, you can play with your own little toys and Dread can come into those stories as well.
I really want you to pitch At Home with the Dreads now as like an ongoing family sitcom.
That would be great. With a laugh track filmed in front of a live studio audience. Yeah.
I tried to make the boyfriend like the most anti-Dread person I could think of, really.
He offers Dread a Christmas cracker, doesn't he? Yeah. He's so stunned for what to say as Dread stares at him. He just says, "Pull cracker."
Yeah.
The weirdest thing anyone could ever say to Judge Dredd, really.
I mean, the whole thing kind of reminded me of my relationship with my father-in-law, really. I had plenty to draw on, put it that way. Yeah. I remember, without going into too much detail, more than one of my wife's previous boyfriends turned gay. So whenever I would have dinner with Karen's dad and her brother, they'd both look at me and go, "Any minute now, he's going to turn. You'll know it." So I was definitely, that came to mind when I was drawing it. I just wanted to make the boyfriend, like, the Dredd's worst idea of a citizen, really.
He's wonderfully feckless, I thought, was the one word that seemed to pop out when I was reading that story.
Mm. Yeah.
No, I don't think my relationship lasted beyond, for much longer, to be honest with you.
There's more stuff we could do with him, actually.
Yeah.
So I'm quite happy to come back and do another Christmas story at some point.
Cool.
With the collection as it is, I mean, we've touched on this a little bit. What are your favourite beats? You know, I'm not just talking about the funny stuff, but the stuff in the pin stories, the Clegg stories, the other stories that are in here. What are there any moments, you know, you're flicking through and you go, actually, that's one of my favourite bits.
Yeah, Rob.
Well, I like the Christmas dinner very much. I like pretty much every bit of dialogue from the monkeys and the space elevator thing. Sort of I forget what it is. It's something stupid like the genetic monkeys control the means of production. Ooh, ooh, and things like this. It's just sort of, I like the fact that they were sort of, the Clegg manity is just one of those silly lines, but it just really stuck.
The Grunzilla story is in there, isn't it? Is that
your name?
I was particularly relieved when Tharg allowed me to have that ending with with all that fecal mess spreading across the city, I was amazed I was allowed to get away with that. That's something I've always wanted to see in the comic.
Oh, there's your Danny Cannon love letter as well in it. As well.
Oh, yes. Oh, gosh. That's right. I wish they released the same week that the new Dread film came out, didn't they? And they deliberately held on to the death of Danny Cannon to come out the same week that the Carl Urban Dread film came out.
I've got a very good... I was told a very good Danny Cannon story about the making of the first Judge Dredd film, but I suspect we should save that for the pub.
I don't think this is going to... I don't think that the joke would harm Danny Cannon much. Didn't he invent the CSI New York? He's like one of the richest men in America now, I think.
I think he's been directing... he directed a lot of Gotham, the TV show Gotham.
Oh yeah.
I think he was like one of the creators of the CSI franchise, which means that every time they make a new spin-off or every time they do an episode, he's you know, making a living.
He's rolling in it.
I take it. Have you ever had anyone on the Thrill Cast involved with the first film? Has anyone ever?
No, I really wanted to get Charles Lippincott on, and I was about to, I mean, this is fairly grim, but I was literally about to email him when he passed away, which I was, you know, obviously very upset that he'd died, but also a bit gutted that I didn't get the opportunity to get him on the record chatting about it, because obviously he's the stuff he was saying online about it over the years has been fascinating. But I mean, I recently, where is it? Recently spent some hard earned money on the making of Judge Dredd.
Mm.
In the future, One Man Is Law, which, you know, it's obviously a slightly more sanitized version of things, but it's still fascinating, you know, the process that they went through and the thought process.
I mean, we all joke about it, but I don't mind it. And in many ways, it's like the comic version of Judge Dredd. You get different versions of Judge Dredd. Like, even in our book, we've got a comedy Judge Dredd, and we've got a deadly serious serial killer story Judge Dredd. So I just look at the two films like that, really. They're just parts of the same thing, really.
Yeah, I mean, this is a bit of a diversion, but I mean, I got drunk and watched it the other night because I think it was on Now TV or whatever, and it was the first time I'd sat down to watch it all the way through since I saw it in the cinema. Aged, how old was I? 95, 16, 17. And it doesn't hold up.
I haven't seen it for probably decades now, but
I've seen it since I was in the cinema.
I can't remember the last time I saw it, but the stuff I seem to remember stuff in there that I liked. I really liked the overhead, the opening shots of the city.
I mean, this is how this conversation always goes.
We
see it played out on the internet all the time, you know. Love the first 10 minutes, but then he took his helmet off. And that seems to be like the collective experience of people who were Dredd fans at the time.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Martin Barker, the sociologist, wrote an entire book about the Dredd movie and the way that different people reacted to it and... what it means to be a fan of something. And he did like all these gradations of people who are mega fans, people who had read Judge Dredd but didn't consider themselves collectors, all the way through to people who just, it was a wet afternoon, so they thought they'd go and see a movie at the multiplex. And it's absolutely fascinating.
I was watching 3 Days of a Condor last week, and I had a moment, and when Max von Sydow was was chief judge in a Judge Dredd film. That's fairly, you know, if nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, he's got the jawbreaker as well.
Yeah. So I don't know whether Carlos, when he was doing Origins and was portraying Fargo, whether, you know, there's a bit of Sydow in his chin, perhaps.
The only other observation I'd probably want to say is in the Danny Kennan story, someone said to me, yours is the only story with Judge Dredd I've read where Judge Dredd thinks he's going to die and he's completely fine with it. Because there's a scene in it where he's cornered by this massive death ray fired down from space, and there's literally no way out, and he's got a child with him, and Dredd knows it's going to kill him, and he says something like, "Close your eyes, kid. It's not going to hurt." And someone said, "That's the only time I read that in a Dredd story where Dredd kind of admits defeat and accepts it, accepts what's coming to him." Really, I don't know if you guys can think of another example of that.
It's always difficult to pick apart his stoicism, because it's the stoicism of the cynical stoicism of characters like Dirty Harry, and you know, straight out of spaghetti westerns and hard-boiled Raymond Chandler cop novels and things like that. So it's often, I think, very difficult to ascertain what he's feeling at all, even if necessarily he's talking about his, you know, what he thinks. And the times that John has done that, John Wagner has done that, you know, it's more around Dredd questioning himself as opposed to necessarily facing his own mortality. He talks about it. He said, you know, I'm not going to be around forever, but that's not really facing your own mortality. That's considering it as something that might happen in the future.
Yeah.
Do you think he's scared? Is he scared of dying, do you think?
No, not at all. Because he just sees himself as part of he's just one cell in a massive creature. Are you scared of losing a hair or fingernail or something? He just sees himself as just one small unit as in this massive body.
Probably sees death as an abstract. You know, for everything that he's been through. So he's been through extraordinary pain. You know, you think about just what happened in The Tale of the Dead Man, where he nearly died. Mm. He's been through indescribable pain. But I guess the point is that he's got such a drive that's not necessarily a desire to live, it's a desire to win.
Mm.
You know, and his criteria for winning is justice is served, whatever, or you know, the law is abided, or punishment is handed out, whatever.
Also, I don't think you can comprehend doing it. I think that used to be the case with Dredd, but I think that's kind of that's kind of faded way now. It's more like he just doesn't have any comprehension of anything else he can do.
He's not a deep thinker, is he? But God bless him.
Think, do you know what? I'm going to retire now, become a security officer, or go backpacking around.
I think as long as he's still got this kind of like burning furnace of anger inside him, he'll keep going forward. Do you know? I think if he ever stopped being angry, I don't think he could ever quantify for a second what he's angry about. That's just all bubbling down there, basically. So
I mean, that's an interesting point, because you know, it's something that's cropped up in your stories, Rob, that you know he's an angry person, where Dredd's often characterized as this kind of cool, impersonal, you know, no emotion whatsoever. It's all about the law, but there's got to be an emotional driver behind that, whether or not he shows it, really, isn't it?
I don't think he's as angry as he used to be. And I feel like That's why I kind of want a new Judge Dredd from Judge Dredd versus Batman book. Because I think in many ways the two characters have swapped positions since their previous encounters. I feel like Dredd has mellowed a bit, and he's I think he's more understanding of people than he used to be. I mean, you often get the other judges murmuring, "The old man's gone soft." All his experiences has broadened him a little bit, but in contrast, I think where DC have taken Judge Dredd, Batman, he's just a wall of rage now. Anything remotely sympathetic seems to have been burnt away from him. So it'd be quite interesting to have a new Dredd versus Batman book with these. How many years? How many decades later now is it since they last met? 20 years. I feel like they've kind of shifted positions, both of them, in the meantime.
I don't even know where Batman is these days, because there's so many DC's continuity is. You know, so many different people have written him in different ways, and it's like Dredd has the incremental aging thing. Do you know what I mean? It's still the same Dredd. It's still the same continuity. I wouldn't know who Batman is these days. I think it depends who's writing him and which DC incarnation it is. Is it Rebirth? Is it sort of, whatever DC is now? So
That's true.
But if you're talking about like Frank Miller's Dark Knight Dredd or some Batman, sorry. Yeah. But
it's sound like Dredd that they've given him his own Judge Death now, haven't they?
They have. Very much so. We've digressed again.
No, I like digressions. I like digressions. We just have to.
If there's any way we can get a new Batman Judge Dredd story, I'd put my hands up to draw it.
We'd love to. We'd
absolutely love to. Yeah, make that happen, Mike.
Huh?
Make that happen, Mike.
Oh, yeah. Like that.
There you go.
Absolutely. Mm. Great stuff. Well, thank you very much indeed to Chris and to Rob for just chatting away. It's always nice to have a chat, particularly when we're under lockdown and can't basically go to the pub and hang out. So we'll be back in 7 days' time for more from the Thrillcast, lining up more big interviews. So looking forward to those. If you want to know what's going on with 2000 AD and the Treasury of British Comics from Rebellion, then do make sure you subscribe to our newsletter, which is available at 2000ed.com/thrillmail. That's all one word, thrillmail. It goes out every Wednesday and contains all the news that's fit to print about 2000 AD. So, we'll see you in a week's time, Earthlits. Make sure you're taking care of yourselves and each other through these dark times. Fingers crossed, fairly soon we'll all emerge from this a little bit safer and a little bit happier. So until then, take care.
Alert! 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 Thrill power levels dangerously high. Alert! Alert! Read 2000 AD every week. Ask your comic book store or newsagent now. Subscribe to the galaxy's greatest comic at 2000adonline.com.